started, if you want to take a seat, I want to welcome you this evening. I'm excited that Doug is here to talk on one of the subjects that he spent a lot of time studying. Doug is a pastor from Colorado, and he is an author of several books. So I'm extremely excited. This is actually the first time I've met him in person. We've talked a few times over the phone and on the radio, but I'm never in person. So I'm glad he's here, that he's willing to do this. So I'm just going to let him come up and get started, and I hope you enjoy this. I hope you find it very interesting. So Doug, if you want to come up and get us started, we'll go ahead and begin.
All right. Well, good to be here, everyone. We've been in Ireland here for about 5 days and enjoying ourselves, and this is kind of the highlight for me to be able to tell you about one of my favorite subjects in the world. Something I discovered probably about 10 years ago, and I just haven't been able to stop thinking about it ever since. So you might recognize this. I don't know how many of you have been up to that or not, but I got to go up there 2 days ago to the Giant Causeway, and I put that picture up here because I want you to see that we're going to be talking here about giants. Giants, and I'm going to talk about it as the history, as the Bible tells it to us. So, let's center this up a little bit more. The Giant Causeway, I'm going to start off with some stories that I don't know if you will know or not, but I'm going to tell you about what I learned on the internet anyway. So, according to legend, the columns of the Giant Causeway are the remains of a causeway that were built by a giant. Now, across the sea, if you know this, in Scotland, these basalt columns that, at least on the Ireland side, are about 40 feet in height, are identical on the other side up in Scotland, and they come out of a place called Fingal's Cave on the island of Staffan's inside that cave. So you can see that those are there. So what happened is that the story is told then, and this is where I'm gonna be in big trouble because I'm gonna butcher all these names, okay? But this Irish giant named Finn McCool, which has to be one of the greatest names for a giant I've ever heard in my life, challenged this Scottish giant Benindonner to a fight. And Finn built this causeway across this north channel so that they could meet and have their fight. And all that remains, because it was so long ago, are these two coastal areas. Ireland has founding myths of giants, actually quite a few of them. The Cesare, is that how you say that? our expert who was supposed to be here tonight wasn't able to make it. He couldn't, but that's good news, so I won't have to worry about butchering words. So the founder of Ireland is this girl named Cesare, and she supposedly is the granddaughter of Noah in the stories, and she escaped the flood in her own ark. But not leaving many descendants, she then, the Partholonians, also from the east, who are descendants of the giant Magog, who we will look about at here in a minute, were destroyed by plague. And then the Numidians, who are people from the Caspian Sea, and I want you to remember that, I'll come back to that in a bit, followed their leader Nemed, who fought the monstrous Fomorians. Okay? Here's Magog. Now, this is not, this is as the Irish people tell about this guy named Magog. In the Bible, he is one of the sons of Japheth, who is the son of Noah. And he is, in Irish mythology, a Scythian. Now, that's actually related here to the Caspian Sea idea in terms of geography. So he's a Scythian, a monstrous giant, quote unquote, who was defeated by a British hero. Josephus, who is a Jewish historian writing about the turn of the Common Era, refers to Magog, son of Japheth, as the progenitor of the Scythians, peoples of the north who are north of the Black Sea. Okay. I mentioned the Fomorians a moment ago. I don't know if you know your history of the Fomorians, but the word seems to come from a word "mor," which means a phantom. Okay. So these are called, and this is in the Encyclopedia of Celtic Mythology and Folklore, a monstrous and demonic race who preyed upon the various settlers, waging war, intermarrying, until finally they were defeated by the Tuatha De Danann, A quote, gigantic and evil Fomorian King Balor was related to the Tuatha by his daughter Ethne, whose son was also a half-breed named Lu. The Tuath people come from the goddess Danu, and they defeated the remnant of these Fomorian evil demonic monsters to become the rulers of all of Ireland for many centuries. This is found in a book of folklore called The Book of Invasions that comes from the 12th century. So it was probably an Irish monk or somebody who was trying to write down the history of Ireland and put these stories down. And also in that same book, the origin is uncertain whether they were demons or men. So I want you to remember that, the idea of being demons or men, because we will definitely come back to that a little bit later. But it is said that they were of the progeny of a giant named Beotac. Okay? Another legend. Now, as we were going through these stories on the internet, this fellow wrote that this was his favorite legend, so I thought I'd read it to you. This is a guy named Trey Fullingen. And that's probably the only time I will try and say his name, okay? One day, a tall stranger, some say a giant as high as a wood, came to the court of a high king at Tara, bearing a branch from which he grew three fruits, an apple, an acorn, and a hazelnut. The stranger's name was Trefillian, meaning of three sprouts. From the description, he was clearly a descendant of the other world. I'm going to keep that in your mind as well, other world, okay? He requested of Conan, a just and brave high king, that all the men of Ireland be assembled, and from them he selected seven of the wisest men of knowledge from each quarter of the land, and also seven from Tara. He taught them all about their history and heritage, and shared with them his knowledge. But during that time, not a drop of wine or morsel of food passed his lips, for he was sustained purely by the fragrance of fruits of his branch. I'll stop here for a moment and tell you that. And this is found over in South America. I don't know if you remember the story of Cortez. He comes over to South America, and the peoples who were there at the time, the Aztecs, just kind of gave him everything that they had. And the reason why is because they believed that he was a god who had returned from the past named Quetzalcoatl. The feathered serpent is what they called this guy. And if you've seen the movie that Mel Gibson made called Apocalypto, it tells this story of how then the Aztecs were very quickly destroyed by the Spanish, and they were able to conquer those people. And it was because they had a myth that was about this god Quetzalcoatl coming from the east and coming to teach them all of this knowledge that they had. So when I read this story of this giant, it reminded me very much about that story across the ocean. When his work was done, he gave the fruits from his branch to Fitan, a white-haired ancient one. So Quetzalcoatl is described fairly similarly to that. This guy extracted the seeds and planted them in each quarter of the land, and one in the center, and the trees grew from the seeds to become the five sacred trees of Ireland. I don't know anything about the five sacred trees. I don't know if you've heard about those or not, if they supposedly still stand or not. But these are kind of legends of the founding of Ireland. So I was on a radio show with Michael and Kevin a couple of years ago. We were talking about the giants, and it was Kevin who told me, you know, that there's a giant woman who's buried very near to where we're at. And so when we first got here, Michael takes us up to her grave. She's called the Long Woman, and she's probably just not 5 or 10 miles from here, okay? I'm not going to read the whole story to you that you can go read on her grave, but she's supposedly a 7-foot-tall Spanish woman who married a 7-foot-3 or 4-tall guy from Ireland, and somehow her remains are here. Now, you go to the grave, and the grave is like 20 feet long, so it makes it look like she's really giant, but 7 feet, 7.5 feet tall, I would bet money that this is based on a real tale of a real woman. So all of these are kind of the stories that you have here in Ireland about giants. So you're not without your legends of giants. What I want to do tonight is I want to tell you the story of the giants as it's told in the Bible. Okay, a lot of people don't know that the Bible tells a story of giants. If they know any giant at all, it would be the giant Goliath. When I was first learning about this subject, some friends that I was trying to teach it to, and one of them was very turned off, couldn't stomach the idea of there being giants. And it finally dawned on me, I said, well, you do believe that the Bible teaches the story of David and Goliath, right? He said, yeah. I said, what do you think he is? And all of a sudden it hit him. He's a giant, okay? So the Bible, Goliath is not the only giant in the Bible. Very, very far from it. But I want to start here and tell you this story of this little Jewish boy who slays this giant in Israel. So I want to start by saying this. When people tell this story these days, they often tell it as kind of an allegory. And they'll end up saying that the reason why this story is in the Bible is because it's representing giants that are in your life. What are the giants in your life and how can you slay them? Okay? I want to tell you that that has nothing whatsoever to do with why this story is in the Bible. This was discovered about 5 years ago in the city of Gath, which is along the coast in the Mediterranean, right where Goliath was said to be from. They call it the Goliath Shard, and it's one of the oldest inscriptions that's ever been discovered in that city. It dates all the way back to the time of David, which would be 3,000 years ago to us. It has two names written on it, right here in Hebrew, and one of those two names is the name Goliath. Okay, so at the very least, we know that this was an historical name of that they were actually calling their children. The Bible tells us the stories that it tells us, and by its own language, it purports to be telling us real history. So people may read the Bible and say, I think that that's ridiculous, I think it's fantasy, but the Bible itself believes that it's telling real history. Probably the most important thing that I could tell you about this would be something that the Apostle Paul said about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. He said, if the dead are not raised, not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile and you're still in your sins. But in fact, Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. And he says, if in Christ we have hope in this life only, we are of all people most to be pitied. The point being that the Apostle Paul is going from town to town to town, country to country to country, staking everything that he has on this idea that Jesus Christ has been really, truly raised from the dead. Okay, just a little bit earlier in that very chapter of the Bible, he talks about how Jesus was seen by one person, three people, 12 people, 500 people, and he basically says, if you don't believe me, go and ask any one of them because they saw him too. So the Bible tells us that it believes that the stories that it tells us are real history. So I'm going to tell you the story of David and Goliath. This story starts, we go way back to the days of after Moses and Joshua, when there's chaos in the land of Israel. And there's no kings that are ruling anywhere. They just have what are called judges. And these judges are not good men. Okay, they would be raised up and they would deliver the people of Israel, and then the people of Israel would fall into sin and rebellion, and God would have to raise up another judge. And this point got to the point where it says in the very last verse of the book of Judges, everyone was doing what was right in his own eyes. Sounds very, very much like the days of today. So you come then to the next book in the story, the book of Samuel, and the people start saying, we want a king. We want a king like all the other nations around us. What they were doing is they were rejecting God as their king and saying that they wanted another king. What did it mean that they want a king like all the others of the nations? So it tells us right after that, they chose a fellow named Saul. Saul is an Israelite, but he's from the tribe of Benjamin. And it tells us this very strange thing about Saul. It says that he was from his shoulders upwards taller than any of the people. And what would that have to do with wanting kings that are like the other nations around them? I think that's actually quite relevant. We'll see this when we come to, for example, King Og of Bashan. What's interesting is that in the story then, Saul is challenged by the Philistine, and he says, no way am I going to fight that guy. So the guy who's a head taller than any other Israelite cowers before this giant Philistine. And it leaves the story up to David, who is just an ordinary average Israelite. So we'll put him about 5'5", to fight and conquer this giant. And the story is that David takes with him 5 stones and a slingshot. And he goes up to the giant, slings the slingshot, hits him in the head. The giant topples over. David picks up Goliath's own sword, which by all accounts was gigantic, chops off Goliath's head, okay, with his own sword. And this interesting story arises that David takes the head of Goliath to Jerusalem and puts it on display, and through a kind of confusion of words that goes on, at the place that Jesus ends up being crucified, a place called Golgotha, the place of the skull, possibly where it gets that name from, and also sometimes called the Mount of Goliath. So that's the story of David and Goliath. It tells us where Goliath comes from. It says that Goliath is said to be descended from the Rephaim. The Rephaim. I don't know if you've heard this word before, but it's an important word in the Bible that appears fairly regularly. So remember that Goliath is descended from the Rephaim. And we'll go on, tell a little bit more about Goliath. Now, I put quotes in, brothers in quotes here, so that Goliath had 5 brothers. Put it in quotes, because I don't think that he was related to them, but the idea seems to be that these were 5 guys that were fairly similar to Goliath in the days of David. Tell you about who they are. First one is a guy named Lani. He probably was Goliath's brother. Virtual twin. It says that they both had spears like a weaver's beam. That would put the spear diameter at 3 inches, okay? Which is approximately 3 times the width of the average spear. It then tells us, and this is all in one chapter in the book of Samuel and Chronicles, which is a parallel to it. It tells us about an Egyptian giant. It doesn't name him, but it tells us that he's 7.5 feet tall. Have you ever been around somebody who's like even 6.5 feet tall? I had a roommate who was 6'6". Intimidating. Go a head taller than that. Another head taller than that. Now you're up to that Egyptian guy. There's a fellow named Ishi Benab in the same chapter. It tells us they had a spear tip that weighed 7.5 pounds. Just the spear tip. Tells us of a giant named Sipai. Doesn't tell us any more about him. And then it gives us an unnamed giant, and it tells us only that he had 24 fingers and toes. Kind of strange thing. So, a while ago I came across this diagram only on the left. The easiest way to determine your descent. For Western folks, if you're Egyptian, you look at your feet, then they go like that. If you're Roman, like that. Greek, like that. Germanic, here's Celtic for you. Or do your feet look like that? So I decided to add my own and say, that's how you know if you're a Nephilim. Get your 6th toe, and it's a really big, big foot. All right. So these 5 are also said to be, well, first of all, these 5 are defeated by David. And David has a bunch of what are called mighty men. There's 30 of these guys. And then there's a special select group of these guys in the story that are closest to David. And these guys have incredible feats of victory in war. And these 5 brothers are defeated by what are called David's giborim, his mighty men. Okay? The giants cannot stand before the Israelite army. Now, all 5 of these guys are said to be descended from the giants. Now, giants is the term Rapha, and that's interesting because it's the same thing that Goliath is said to be descended from, the Rapha, the Rephaim. Okay? It could be either a shorthand for the people group called the Rephaim or from a person who might have been their progenitor named Rapha. Rapha just means to heal, a healer. It can have other connotations too, as we'll see in a little bit. So I want to mention one thing about how tall was Goliath. This here on the left is about how tall David would have been. So this is about to scale. Okay, so this is about 5'5 for David. Now, here's Saul, about a head taller. So I'm putting him about here. Now there's different translations of the Bible. There's an ancient translation in Greek called the Septuagint. It was translated by 70 Jewish scholars who were living in Egypt. And that translation has Goliath at 6'9". Now, if you'll notice the difference here between Saul and Goliath, that's not very much. Okay? So, telling you about my roommate. I was in college, 6'6". And I thought, you know, he was intimidating, but I don't think I would have cowered in utter fear over my roommate if he could challenge me to a fight. The Hebrew Bible puts Goliath at about 9'9". Now, that's quite a bit more, if you look at it. There's another giant in the Bible. His name is Og, and it has his bed. Now, it's only his bed. It's not his dimensions themselves, but his bed at 12 feet. Okay, that's pretty big. So the question is, how did these guys get here in Israel in 1000 BC? Well, it tells us in the book of Joshua, which comes before David and Goliath, that story, by 400 years or something like that, that there was none of the Anakim living in the land of the people of Israel that were left, except for only in three towns. Town of Gaza, which is still there today, okay, it's one of the capital of Palestine, Gath and Ashdod. These are three coastal towns on the side of the Mediterranean that even Israel doesn't own to this day. So it's still kind of foreign territory. Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod. Now, one of those cities, Gath, is where Goliath is from. So imagine this. It's telling us in the book of Joshua that there are still giants that are left in Gath 400 years before Goliath comes. And now you come to the story of Goliath in the Bible and you see that, oh, he's from that town. Well, of course, because there's still giants that are left there. Now, it tells us in that same book that there was a person named Anak. Okay? He's the progenitor of these Anakim. So, these guys, there's none of the Anakim left in the land of the people of Israel, and Anak is their founder. He has an ancestor whose name is Arba. So Anak originally meant neck, but came to mean long-necked, as in a giant. Arba was the founder of what might be the oldest city in Israel, and it's one of the oldest cities on planet Earth, a city called Hebron. That they've done excavations on, by the way, that gigantic walls and gigantic doorways, and I don't know quite what to make of that. It would be a fallacy to say that it's because there were giants there, but I think there could be some relation to that. Okay? This name of Hebron, the older name for it was called Kiriath Arba. And it was named after this fellow named Arba, who was called the greatest of the Anakim. And Arba can mean perfect stature, possibly physical size. Anak had three sons. Now, these guys were still living in the days of Moses and Joshua. Okay? They went to the Negev, they came to Hebron. These are the names of the three sons, Ahiman, Sheshai, and Talmai, the descendants of Anak who are there. And this is the story when that comes up in the book of Numbers, where the Israelites are told to go into the land and spy it out. Okay, and they have 40 days to go in there. They come back to Moses. 10 of the 12 spies say, we don't want to have anything to do with the people there, because the sons of Anak are there. As they're coming back, they're carrying on between two people this gigantic thing of grapes that became enshrined kind of in mosaics and other pictures that the Israelites would draw later in the land there. And this is the story where it says that they said, we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who come from the Nephilim. Now, if you've heard of any giant tribes, I was talking with Mick back there earlier, Nephilim is probably the one that you've heard of. So I'm going to tell you about the Nephilim. This comes from Genesis 6:4. It's one of the most asked questions I get is, who are the Nephilim? This is what the text says. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came to the daughters of man, and they bore children to them, these were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. Okay? So let me give you the meaning of the word. A lot of people say that the word comes from a Hebrew word meaning to fall. In other words, the Nephilim are the fallen ones. This is actually not correct. It comes from an Aramaic word, naphil, which means a giant. And this is why when the Greeks were, the Greek Jewish speakers were translating the Septuagint, they translated the word as giant, okay, not fallen ones. This is because there's an altered spelling that's the only way that you can account for that. And also because of the translation, the giants in the Septuagint. So the word Nephilim actually means a giant. Now, this other group called the Rephaim that I said that Goliath and these other guys were descended from becomes a generic name for giants throughout the Old Testament. For example, you read in Deuteronomy 2, and now this is a whole chapter that recounts the people that are around Israel that have to fight the giants that are living in their times as well. So it says the Emim, like the Anakim, are regarded as Rephaim. Or a little bit later, it says, it is regarded as the land of Rephaim, for the Rephaim formerly lived there, but the Ammonites called it the Zamzumim. The meaning of Rephaim, as I said earlier, means to heal. And we find these guys in some very strange places. For example, in the book of Job, which is probably the oldest book that we have in the Old Testament, it says the Rephaim tremble under the waters. The idea being there that these are kind of the guardians of Sheol, which is translated as Hades, which we translate as hell into English. Some translations of this text here, the Rephaim, say the giants tremble under the waters. Some say the ghosts, and some say the shades. And these are all probably fine translations, and I will tell you why that is here in a little bit. I'll give you some other giant tribes in Canaan, because what I'm trying to do is impress upon you that Goliath is not the only giant in the Old Testament. I mentioned earlier this group called the Zamzumim. They're also shortened to the Zuzim. This means the high-standing ones, which is an interesting translation, or the buzzing ones. I'll tell you two things about the buzzing ones. When Moses goes into the promised land, God tells him that he will send the hornet if they do not obey him. And I've often thought, I wonder if that has anything to do with these guys buzzing, the name of the word, the Zamzumim. But I'll also tell you this, how many of you ever watched or saw anything about Andre the Giant? Fascinating guy. Have you ever heard him talk? The rumbling in his voice reminds me, like no other human I've ever heard, of a buzzing sound. Okay? And Andre was truly a magnificent human being. At his height, he was 7'4", weighed over 500, maybe 600 pounds. Just absolutely a monster. And so, the Zamzumim. There's a group called the Emim. They're called the Terrible Ones. And in Deuteronomy 2, they're called the people as great, numerous, and tall as the Anakim. There's a group called the Horites. They lived in the land where Petra is. This is the red fabled city that you see in the third Indiana Jones movie. Last Crusade. They're sometimes called troglodytes or cave dwellers. Got to go up to the giant causeway, as I said, and just a couple miles over, there was that bridge. What's that bridge called, Mike?
Kerikeri Bridge.
Yeah, and there was some caves that were underneath that bridge. And I was just very thankful that I didn't see any bones of humans there, because I would have thought Grendel lived there. Okay? In the city of Lovelock, Nevada, there's a cave. And this cave was, I'll tell you a little bit about this story a little bit later, but this cave has some very strange associations with giants. All right, so wet your whistle for that one. There's a group called the Amalekites. These guys' name means vexation or to lick up. I wouldn't want to fight these guys. Numbers calls them the first of nations. Moses defeats them with the sign of the cross. We'll see that as well here again. There's something else here with these guys. They're a giant clan, and in the days of Samuel, just before David, comes along. There's a king named Agag, and one of the most strange stories in the Old Testament, it says that King Saul captures Agag and refuses to kill him. And Samuel comes and says, what is this that you're doing, not killing Agag? And it says that he hacks Agag to pieces because Saul refused to do it. Absolutely gruesome. Well, it tells us that Agag is actually descended from the Amalekites. All right? The book of Esther is probably the last history book that we have in the Bible. And it tells us about kind of three people. Esther, who means star, and her uncle Mordecai, who means, strangely, little man. And Mordecai's nemesis in the story is a guy named Haman. Haman is descended from the Agagites, which means he's descended from the Amalekites. And Haman tries to hang Mordecai on giant gallows that are like 60 feet tall. It's a very strange story when you start seeing these connections to the giants. It's even stranger. They're called the Amorites. They're called the mountain people or the people of renown. The book of Amos, he's a prophet of Israel. He says, I destroyed the Amorite, though his height was like the height of the cedars. So several chapters in the Old Testament kind of give us lists of giant clans. And when you put them all together, you end up with about 16 to 17 different clans of giants. There's kind of a family tree of them that I'll just skip past that. In the land of Canaan, city of Jerusalem is somewhere right about here. Up here, Sea of Galilee, and this is kind of where the giants are located. In other words, they're throughout the entire land of Israel, what's modern Israel, what ancients called the land of Canaan. So I'm going to tell you about some wars that took place. The first one is found in Genesis 14. This is a story of some kings from the east who come to fight some kings from the land of Canaan, and it tells us that they go in there and they defeat, and this is where several of these first appear, the Anakim, the Zazum, the Zuzim, the Emim. And so in other words, they're going in there and they're clearing house with regard to the giant clans. This is in the days of Abraham. So that takes us back to about 2000 BC. Deuteronomy 2, as I mentioned earlier, tells us that there was several of these groups that had extended their land. So the nation of Israel really only went to about here, okay? And over here you'd have the Moabites and you'd have the Edomites and some other non-Israelite nations that were over here. They had to fight these same guys. Exodus 17 tells us about these Amalekites. And this is the story where Moses is getting ready to go into the promised land and he comes across these giant Amalekites and they have this fight and Moses and his armies cannot win unless his arms are held up like this. And what does that shape make? The shape of a cross, kind of foreshadowing something that would come many centuries later. Numbers 21 tells us the story of Moses then going into Canaan. So the Amalekites are probably somewhere down here. They end up having to wander in the wilderness way, way down here, okay? For 40 years. And then when they finally go into the promised land, they come in from up here. And they come in from kind of the east to west. And this tells us that there's a couple of giants up there named Og and Sion. And they're from a place called Bashan. Okay, Numbers 13 kind of tells that too. Joshua, we already mentioned those. These are the wars with the Anakim giants that Joshua has to end up getting. They get rid of almost all of them except for in those three towns. Then we come to the book of Samuel. That's the story of Agag. Then Samuel 17, that's the story of David and Goliath. First Chronicles starts telling us the stories of those giants that I began with at the beginning. The book of Esther to kind of complete it. In other words, what we've got here is almost from the beginning of the history after the flood that we know of to the very last history book in the Old Testament, there are stories that are either directly or indirectly related to giants, and they're all kind of warfare stories. So the question I have is that where the giant stories end? If you'd ask somebody, are there giants anywhere in the New Testament? Almost everybody would say, of course there aren't. So what happened to the giants? So most of them were killed off in the land of Canaan in the early days. That was the point of these wars. Okay, these guys were, I need to tell you a little bit about this. According to the histories, and it's not just the history of the Bible. You can go to the history, I'll tell you about this Lovelock Cave in Nevada a little bit later. It's the same kind of an idea. These guys were wicked. They were cannibals. They were into some very nasty things, and they had to be destroyed. They did not treat the smaller folk very well at all. Okay? So they were driven out into the other nations. My opinion is that this is where the stories of the myths start coming from. I'm going to tell you about some migration. I said at the very beginning, I want you to remember kind of the Caspian Sea. Remember the, I forget what the other two ideas that were. So there's the Caspian Sea. And there were some other words that were associated with areas over here. So this history comes from both an ancient history and a newer one that I read. It kind of seems to see that they start over here somehow, and they migrate in two directions. One goes kind of north over the Black Sea, resides over here. One goes south. This takes you into the land of Babylon, modern-day Iraq. Takes you down into the land of Canaan. Takes you up into the land of Galatia. There's a New Testament book called Galatians. This is modern-day Turkey. They come up, and then every place that they go, they're kicked out. Okay? So you come up to Germany and France, ancient Gaul. And Julius Caesar, in his wars, talks about how the Romans really wanted to conquer Gaul, but they couldn't do it. And he tells us because the people who were up there were so huge, his armies couldn't beat them. They seem to have gone up into Britain when the Romans finally destroyed them, and over here into Ireland. Then, believe it or not, they actually make their way across the sea into North America. This is a picture, an ancient kind of a brooch of a Kurgan or Scythian war warrior. And I want you to notice where his feet are at. Basically touching the bottom of the ground on this horse. I saw a mini horse yesterday at one of the places that we were visiting. This is not no mini horse. This is a horse. And they also depicted them in their rock art the same way. In other words, these are big guys. Now, they're not 50 feet tall, but they're big. Okay. So that kind of takes you on the migration. I'm going to tell you a little bit about this story. I think now's the time to do it in North America. So it's actually, maybe I'll wait for one more little minute here. So at the end of the story, let's go to the New Testament. I'm going to talk about Jesus and whether or not he fought giants at all. So in the New Testament, we find something very strange, not found really in the Old Testament at all. And it's the idea of Jesus casting demons out of people. And this happens all the time in the Gospels. Okay? The book of Revelation talks about Babylon as a haunt of demons. Okay? Babylon's demons, that language comes from two passages in the prophecy of Isaiah, both referring to Babylon. And in those prophecies, you have some very strange words. So I don't know if most of you can see this or not. But you've got here a line of Hebrew words, and then you've got the Greek translation of these words. And then here are how we have translated these in various translations into English. So let me give you some of these words. Now remember, I want you to think about that. Demon is an umbrella word, okay? And then these are the words that are subsumed under it. So you've got monsters, devils, satyrs. Do you know what a satyr is? Okay, a half man, half goat. They're called the Howling. They're called night monsters. They're called dragons. They're called centaurs. Half man, half bull. Okay, so these are, in other words, those are considered demonic creatures by the Israelites of old. Why would giants be, how or why would giants be associated with demons? So, this is a kind of the first church historian that we know of. His name is Eusebius. Eusebius had this to say. He said, for one might say that those demons are those giants, and that their spirits have been deified by the subsequent generations of men, and that their battles and their quarrels among themselves and their wars are the subjects of the legends that are told as of gods. Now, Eusebius was not the first, was not the only person to say this. This is in Augustine's City of God, one of the most famous books in Western civilization. He tells us that the opinions of the Greeks was that the demons were the heroes of old. That's very similar to what Eusebius just said. Okay? Now, Augustine says they're not gods, but they hold a middle place between the gods and men. See why that is here in a moment. Justin Martyr, who was one of the very first writers that Christianity has, going back to the early second century, says the angels transgressed their appointment and were captivated by the love of women and begat children who are those that are called the demons. All right? Now, it's not these three. It's every single church father that we know of in the first three centuries, except for one, believed this is the origin of the demons. And I'm going to tell you about that origin here as we go along. It's also the Jews. So the book of Enoch was written prior to the New Testament by some Jew or group of Jews as it was compiled together. I'll read a little bit from this. It says, and now the giants who are produced from the spirits of flesh shall be called evil spirits on the earth, and on the earth shall be their dwelling. Evil spirits have proceeded from their bodies because they are born of men, and from the holy watchers is their beginning and primal origin. They shall be evil spirits on earth, and evil spirits they shall be called. The idea is that these are creatures that become spirits of the air because they're neither fully earthly nor fully heavenly. And so what's between heaven and earth? It's the air. As for the spirits of heaven, in heaven shall be their dwelling, but for the spirits of earth, which were born upon the earth, and earth shall be their dwelling, and the spirits of the giants, they afflict, oppress, destroy, attack, do battle, and work destruction on earth and cause trouble. They take no food, but nevertheless hunger and thirst and cause offenses. And these spirits shall rise up against the children of men and against the women, because they have proceeded from them. From the days of the slaughter and destruction and death of the giants, they shall destroy until the day of the consummation, the great judgment of which the age shall be consummated, over the watchers and the godless, yea, shall be wholly consummated. So I'm going to take you back to this verse that we read. It's verse 4, and I'm going to read the three verses that come right before it. This is the story that the Bible uses to introduce the flood to us. The flood story is known not just in Israel, but everywhere. Basically, every ancient culture, it doesn't matter if you're in Middle East, if you're in China, if you're in Ireland, if you're in North America, South America, Egypt, it doesn't matter. They all have a flood story, okay? This is how the Bible chooses to begin its flood story. It says, when man began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw the daughters of man were attractive, and they took them as their wives, any they chose. Then the Lord said, my spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward, when the sons of God came to the daughters of men and bore children to them. These are the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. Now I'm going to highlight the different groups that are in this text. First of all, you have men. Now, don't you notice this? It's called man, of man, in man, his flesh. Second group are women. They're called daughters, daughters of men. They're called their wives, daughters of men. Third group is a group called the sons of God. Sons of God. Fourth group is a group called the Nephilim. They appear only in verse 4. But they are also called the mighty men who are of old and the men of renown. So the group that we need to try and figure out who they are, what they are, is the third group. It's this group called the sons of God. Job, back to this oldest book of the Bible, it tells us very clearly that these are not human beings. And it does this because it's telling a story of God creating heaven and earth. And it asks Job this question. It says, Job, I am making the very foundations of heaven and earth. Before there's any living humans or animals or anything else, I want to know, Job, where were you? Because Job thinks he knows everything. And God wants to show him that maybe he doesn't know quite everything that there is after all. And it says, as it's talking about sinking the bases and the cornerstones of the earth and laying the line and stretching it out, basically doing all the measuring and everything he needs to do to create the earth, he says, where were you when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Okay, so Adam hasn't been created yet. Only heavenly beings are there. Job, where were you when the sons of God were there shouting for joy when I was creating? At the very beginning of the book of Job, it starts this way. It says, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. So you've got this picture scene of this group, an entourage led by Satan, going into heaven to have this kind of courtroom scene with God over the person who becomes the main figure in the book, which is Job. What that scene depicts is something called the divine council. This phrase is found in the book of Psalms. This is Psalm 82, verse 1, a psalm of Asaph. God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. I'm going to give you a little bit, well, this is actually all of that psalm. It's only 8 verses long. I just read to you the first verse. I'm going to come down and read just parts of this near the end. In verse 5, it talks about how these gods that God, that he's judging, neither have knowledge nor understanding. They walk about in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken because of them. He says, you are gods, sons of the Most High, all of you. This is the language of the sons of God, okay? Sons of the Most High. But he says, you're going to die like men, like any prince.